The countdown begins. Confirmation from Pearson that it is talking to Random House about a merger with Penguin, its trade house, could see the Big Six drop a notch. And in reviews, an author offers tips to think like Sherlock Holmes. Hint, clean out the attic first. Welcome, everyone, to Copyright Clearance and his podcast series. I'm Chris Keneally, host of Beyond the Book, and every week on Friday, we turn to the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for a review of the week's news and a look ahead to what everyone will talk about next week in the world of books. Joining me from his Manhattan office is Andrew Albanese, PW's features editor, and welcome, Andrew.
Greetings, Chris.
Well, it's great to have you back on. I should tell everybody I'm speaking to you today from 9,300 feet at the Keystone Resort in the Colorado Rockies, where PubWest, the Publishers Association of the West, is holding its annual conference. This morning's keynote from Orrin Teicher, CEO of the ABA, the American Booksellers Association, found him calling for a closer alliance between indie publishers and indie booksellers. He reported that unit sales for ABA members are up 12% year over year, and among other things, he touted ABA's partnership with Kobo. Teicher said that 400 stores had already signed up to install the ABA Kobo e-reader promotion. Beyond the Book will carry his talk in our Monday podcast, and Andrew, you come with us with some news on several other conferences.
Hey, that's right, Chris. So in San Francisco right now, we have the Internet Archives Books and Browsers meeting, and that's organized by Peter Brantley, and he's also a PW contributing editor, as you may know. And here in New York, we have the NRA Books Conference, which is organized by the New York Law School, and James Grimmelman, who is another contributing editor here at Publishers Weekly. So you can check out coverage of both of those conferences on the PW website. Next week, we'll have a ton of coverage. I imagine both Peter and James will be blogging about them. And I'll also have a report on the NRA Books event, which I've been able to attend since it's right here in Manhattan. A few quick high-altitude impressions. I love both of these shows. You know, for my money, these are two great events because they're very future-oriented, but they're also rooted in, you know, present-day publishing practice. And they not only address sort of the traditional cultural values and business practices around the book business and around literature, but also a digital perspective as well. So, you know, and for all the disruption in the book business, both conferences really sort of point a future that is, you know, pretty undeniably robust for readers and for the information business in general. So you'll want to check out PW Online next week for some great coverage of both of these events.
Well, you know, Andrew, I'm always attending or often attending conferences on the future of publishing. And I've come to the conclusion that if there is a future for publishing, it's conferences on the future of publishing.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's not a week goes by that we don't have, have that sort of thing.
My calendar is full of them as well, no
doubt. Right. But, you know, the future is, of course, much on the minds of people in publishing. And we've got some news that's going to point to a future much changed if things turn out as expected. We have talk of a merger between Penguin and Random House.
Yeah, that's potentially huge news. And it's something I think we've all been anticipating for a while, that there would be some more consolidation in the industry. But yeah, the Big Six could very well become the Big Five. Now, the rumors have been circulating for a few days, and that eventually forced Penguin's corporate parent Pearson to issue a statement this week confirming that, yes, it is indeed in merger talks with Random House. You know, all we know so far is that there's no agreement, obviously, and there's actually no certainty that these discussions are actually going to lead anywhere. But we're going to be following this pretty closely next week and beyond, you can be sure. And we're going to be gauging industry reaction to the idea of the sale. And so far, there's been, you know, somewhat of an outcry, some concern in the social media world. And there's even been a meme called Random Penguin that's emerged, though I much prefer Penguin House, personally. So some quick thoughts on this. You know, this would be a pretty massive stroke of consolidation for an industry that has already been pretty steadily consolidating for decades. You know, Random House is the world's largest English language publisher, and Pearson clocks in at number one in our Global 50 rankings of all international publishing operations. Their combined American operations would have sales approaching $2 billion, and that would give Random Penguin or Penguin House about a 15 to 20% share of the total trade market based on book stats. As our editor Jim Millia pointed out this week, you know, let's see Amazon try to bully a company with, you know, that kind of market share. But at the same time, there's also fears that a company of that size, a publisher of that size, could do a little bullying of its own, shall we say. You know, we've already heard some agents express concerns about a potential lack of competition. As one agent put it, there would be fewer publishers to submit to, lower advances. And this is indeed something we have seen over years of consolidation in the industry, that, you know, there's less competition among imprints, and advances, at least for the mid-list books, have gone down. So for booksellers, there's also concerns that this potentially merged company could have pretty enormous clout. You know, one Random House and Penguin customer noted that these two houses combined make up almost a third of their bookstore sales. You know, Random House is already the gorilla going through my checkbook, she said, and together they would be the elephant. And a merger also would probably trim the two companies' workforces. You know, there would obviously be overlap among imprints and operations and probably some duplicate positions. But at the same time, with the growth we're seeing in digital and with ebooks, there's probably going to be new positions added as the company grows. So it may be a little too early to speculate how that's all going to shake out. Of course, it's all speculation at the present time, but we'll be keeping an eye on this at PW, and you can check out the PW website next week for more.
Right, indeed. And, you know, I have to say I'm with you on the Penguin House notion. It puts me in mind of that line from one of the Beat Poets about penguin dust. I want penguin dust. We also have reports from the Supreme Court, and they're going to take up a case that's going to really have potentially far-reaching impact on the book business. It's all about first sale.
That's right. So on Monday, the Supreme Court was going to hear oral arguments that could decide whether the long-held first sale rights under the Copyright Act extends to goods manufactured overseas. Specifically, the case is going to address the fallout from an August 2011 ruling in John Wiley & Sons versus Supab Kurtsang. Now, Kurtsang is a Thai-born U.S. student who was successfully sued by Wiley for importing and reselling in the U.S. foreign editions of Wiley textbooks that were made for sale exclusively abroad. Now, in its verdict, the three-judge panel of the Second Circuit affirmed, by a 2-1 margin, that Kurtsang could not avail himself of the first sale doctrine because the law says the products must be lawfully made. The Second Circuit held that those two little words, lawfully made, limited first sale specifically and exclusively to works that were made in territories where the U.S. Copyright Act is law and not to foreign manufactured works. Now, that has raised alarms for a number of businesses and for libraries, especially also used booksellers and online sellers like Amazon and eBay, for example, because if lawfully made, if that was the law of the land, if it was to stand, that would mean the publishers could theoretically control the distribution of books not only published overseas, but merely printed abroad. In other words, as the ruling now stands, once you buy a book, you know, as the law now stands, excuse me, once you buy a book, first sale allows you to lend it out or to resell it. But technically, in the future, if this ruling was to stand, if the book was printed in China, for example, you could lose that right. So opponents are pretty wary that upholding that Second Circuit lawfully made ruling is going to give corporations a chance to lock down distribution channels through copyright. And it would also serve as an incentive for U.S. publishers to ship their printing jobs to Mexico or Canada or China or wherever, because it would give them that little extra measure of control. Now, publishers have totally downplayed fears. They say that this is the ruling. This ruling needs to stay on the books to protect copyrights. And they call all of this idea that we're going to outsource our jobs, our printing jobs on mass, is an extravagant hypothetical, they say. So on Monday, the Supreme Court's going to get its chance to weigh in on this. So, and we're going to be following up on this issue as well. And it also, because it strikes at the owner, idea of ownership in the digital age. And that's a topic we've been covering quite a bit lately, too. As you may know, there's a company called Redigi that is currently fighting to extend first sale to the digital realm. And recently, Random House kind of muddied the waters, the ownership waters, by suggesting that libraries own the ebooks that they sell, when that's, you know, clearly not the case. They're very much licensed. And Peter Brantley has a great post on that whole mess on the PW blog right now. In any case, we're going to be following this case at the Supreme Court very closely, and more on first sale and ownership in the coming week. So on PW.com.
We will look for all of that and look forward to having you back next week. Andrew Albanese, PW Features Editor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And now we'll turn to Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Genreville for the Weekly Review of Reviews. Welcome back, Rose.
Thank you, Chris. It's really good to be back after my long hiatus. And by the way, I do have to say that I am a random penguin adherent.
You prefer random penguin. Okay,
I absolutely prefer random penguins. I mean, random penguin.
We'll have to keep an eye on that and we'll see how it all turns out. But listen, Rose, we are very happy to have you back. I look forward to the rundown from you. We'll start out, as we often do, with fiction. Tell us what we've got there.
There's no Q&A in the fiction section this week, so we move right on to our highlighted reviews. We cover Spectacle, which is Susan Steinberg's short story collection. Our reviewer says it defies category. It's narrated entirely by women whose voices merge, divide, recur, and dissipate into one another. At the center of each story is the same unnamed woman who's constantly set against male counterparts like abusive or aloof boyfriends, a controlling and damaged father, or hostile brother. And Steinberg subverts the feminist critique of women identified only by their male counterparts and delivers a multifaceted female protagonist who whispers her secrets, shouts her confusions, and rends her relationships to find some meaning in the wreckage. So, needless to say, we think this is a masterpiece of contemporary short fiction. We also cover Swamplandia's Karen Russell's new book. It's a slim but potent short story collection, Vampires in the Lemon Grove. And in stories like The Seagull Army Descends on Strong Beach, 1979, Russell traps your basic dejected 14-year-old boy in a beach town where the seagulls have secrets. She creates whole landscapes and lifetimes of strangeness within the confines of a short story, even when the story traffics in recognizable modern life, like The New Veterans, which is a story about a masseuse and an Iraq war veteran haunted by his buddy's death. So Russell really blurs horror, the genre, with the horror of daily life.
In mystery and thriller, there's a tale of two brothers.
Yeah, Lachlan Smith's legal thriller debut, Bear is Broken, which is a Leo Maxwell mystery, really grabs the reader by the throat and doesn't let go. And it features, as you said, two brothers, one of whom is a defense lawyer and the other is a freshly minted attorney. When they're having lunch at a San Francisco restaurant, a gunman walks in and shoots the defense lawyer in the head. So with him in a coma with little chance for recovery, Leo must take over an important case for his brother and find out the who and the why of the murder attempt. We also have a review of Larry Bond and Jim DeFelice's Larry Bond's Red Dragon Rising, Blood of War, which is the fourth and final volume in this military action series. And it's got blazing combat, heroic deeds, and the sometimes sad, sometimes joyful stories of the men and women who are helping Vietnamese people defend themselves against a Chinese attack on their homeland. So newcomers should start with the first entry, Shadows of War, but they will find themselves racing through the whole series without a pause. And we have a Q&A with Priscilla Royal, author of The Sanctity of Hate, which is a medieval historical that explores anti-Semitism in 13th century England. In the science fiction, fantasy, and horror section, we have a new anthology from prolific editor John Joseph Adams. For a while, it seemed like every science fiction or fantasy anthology had his name on it, and now he's editing magazines as well. He's really getting out there in every section of the genre. This one is called Epic, and it's a fantasy collection that lives up to its title in scale and at least partly in substance. There are 17 selections that range widely in theme, taking in faith, power, magic, and science. And genre legends like Ursula K. Le Guin and Michael Moorcock make appearances, but the collection's three standouts come from relative newcomers, Mary Robinette Cole, N.K. Jemisin, and Carrie Vaughn. Though this anthology isn't one of Adams' most compelling collections, it still definitely merits a place on fantasy fans' bookshelves besides his earlier offerings.
In romance this week, Rose, there's a novel that takes us to a place romance frequently doesn't go, which is into the trunk of a car.
Yeah, this is a spellbinding novel of romantic suspense called Shiver, written by Karen Robards, who's a bestseller and very popular in the genre. It stars a 23-year-old single mother trying to make ends meet. She works nights repossessing cars while taking classes for EMT certification during the day. And then she finds an injured man in the trunk of a BMW she's repossessing. Then suddenly she's assaulted and thrown in the trunk with him. Needless to say, sparks fly, insofar as there's room for them to do that inside the trunk of a car. So the man turns out to be an undercover FBI agent, and the two of them try to outwit their captors, who are members of a drug cartel. Also, Opposites Attract in Body Heat, a sizzling contemporary from Susan Fox. No relation, as far as I know. Maura Mahoney, who's an accountant angling for a promotion at a senior living facility, is leading a staid existence when she meets hunky construction worker Jesse Blue, who's assigned to community service there after defending a friend from her abusive boyfriend. An instant mutual attraction leads to hot fantasies, but Maura is reluctant to risk disappointing her adoptive parents, and Jesse is processing pain from past relationships. So as the two sympathetic leads struggle to overcome their personal issues, readers will cheer them on.
And some of the books in nonfiction this week just proved the point that, Sherlock Holmes is an industry that will never die. It's over a century old, and we still keep seeing more books appear.
It's true. Books and movies and television shows, and now readers who esteem Sherlock Holmes as superhuman will be pleasantly surprised by Maria Konnikova's first book, Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes, wherein the Scientific American columnist makes good on her premise that the average person can indeed train their mind to emulate the thinking style of the iconic fictional sleuth. Partial proof comes, in fact, from his creator, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who in a number of cases use Holmesian deduction to rectify real miscarriages of justice. So Konnikova starts with the concept of the brain attic, where care is taken to maximize the use of limited thinking space, and she uses illustrated examples from the original stories to make her points. Now, this is not just for Baker Street irregulars. This fascinating look at how the mind works, including lots of real-life studies and engaging thought experiments, will be an eye-opening education for many. Also in nonfiction in the Sherlock Holmes vein, James O'Brien, who's the Emeritus Distinguished Professor of Chemistry at Missouri State University, delves deep into the science behind Sherlock Holmes in The Scientific Sherlock Holmes, a brief and engaging volume. The book is clearly aimed at Holmes aficionados. Each of the 60 stories featuring the detective are referenced via accepted Holmesian shorthand. But the author treats his subject and his associates with obvious affection, and it's catching. His journey into Sherlockian science is both endearing and informative. O'Brien discusses Holmes's investigative acumen according to categories of evidence, providing interesting real-life examples of crime solved with similar techniques, and he even defends Holmes against accusations that he was a pretty pathetic chemist. In other news, in the nonfiction section, a dissatisfied and angry power that is not ready for global leadership. That is the verdict from China Goes Global, A Partial Power, which is a measured deflating assessment of China's global presence. George Washington University political scientist David Shambaugh, who's the author of Charting China's Future, tags the Middle Kingdom with a risk-averse, irresponsible, narrowly self-interested foreign policy that sows mistrust and leaves it with no allies, a modernizing but still weak military, a maladroit public relations effort marred by stilted government sloganeering, and a gaping deficit of soft power in a world that rejects its parochial culture and authoritarian governance. Wow. I sort of want to send China a sympathy card just from having read that summary. And Shambaugh pointedly corrects the usual hysterical exaggerations of Chinese power in an illuminating profile of a colossus that does not yet bestride the world. And finally, we have a review of Faking It, Manipulated Photography Before Photoshop. This is an engrossing volume that coincides with a show at New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art celebrating pre-1990 photo alteration, arguing that its practitioners were every bit as imaginative and, by necessity, more resourceful than today's digital meddlers. It's written by Met assistant curator Mia Feynman, who traces photo fakery to the dawn of the medium over 150 years ago, when artists took quite a lot of license for both aesthetic and commercial ends, whether by inserting clouds into clear skies or huckstering spirit photographs that featured ghosts hovering above portrait subjects. This finely curated collection is an unequivocal delight.
You know, I read the review in the New York Times this week of that show, and it really does sound quite appealing, and the point was made that almost from day one, photography included just that kind of fakery. Fascinating stuff. In the children's and young adult section, what have we got?
On the picture book side, we review The Girl in Red by Aaron Frisch, illustrated by Hans Christian Andersen medalist Roberto Innocenti. It is a striking contemporary tale on the story of Little Red Riding Hood. And just like that story has multiple endings, so does this one. Not all happy. It's set in a broken down near future. In fact, the PW Review says that the artwork combines the busyness of Where's Waldo with the bleak commercial dystopia of Blade Runner. So try and picture that. As a girl named Sophia goes to visit her grandmother and is intercepted by a motorcyclist in dark glasses and a black coat. It is chilling and not easily forgotten. On a lighter note, in fiction, we review Newbery medalist Karen Cushman's Will Sparrow's Road, about a 12-year-old liar and thief in Elizabethan England. And despite Will's dire circumstances, he was abandoned by his mother and sold to an innkeeper by his father in exchange for unlimited ale. There's a lot of humor in this story, and Cushman does a great job of capturing Will's boyish combination of impudence, naivete, and often misplaced self-confidence. We also have a couple of roundups in the section, a grouping of new board books, and another of activity books, including a new pigeon title from Mo Willems.
And finally, Rose, in Pick of the Week, we have an offbeat memoir that is fresh off the boat.
That's right. Fresh off the boat is the memoir of Eddie Huang, who is the founder of the popular East Village food shop Bauhaus. That's B-A-O, as in the Chinese word for buns. And it tells his unconventional immigrant fable with his FOB, fresh off the boat, parents and his unusual relatives living the Yankee dream. Writing with attitude, Huang details his journey from novice cook, sampling Haitian ribs, southern cooking, Japanese izakaya wings, banchan Korean fried chicken, and Taiwanese foods, to finally opening his landmark eatery known for its fashionable, simple Asian street food. Brash, leading edge, and unapologetically hip, Huang reconfigures the popular foodie memoir into something worthwhile, very memorable, and downright edible.
Well, I'm getting hungry just hearing about it. Rose Fox, who reviews for PW, reviews the edges there, and online at Jean-Marville, thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome, Chris. I missed you.
It's really we missed having you on. Rose, good to have you back with us. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as now images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at the Copyright Clearance Center website, copyright.com. Just click on Beyond the Book. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally, coming to you this week from the PubWest Conference in Keystone, Colorado. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.